This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Quiz and Hers, the podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. My name is Hallie, and I am here, as always, with my husband, Justin.
I am here, as always.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Good.
Got a big old hunk of meat braising.
Yep. And soup, and it smells real good.
Yep.
Everything smells really good.
Yep.
And I cooked for once in my life, so there's that.
You did.
I never cook.
No.
Anyway, for those of you who are new to the podcast...
It's not a cooking podcast.
It is not a cooking podcast,
usually.
Even though Justin would love to have a cooking podcast.
That would be fun.
You can only do so many podcasts.
One.
I can only handle one.
Yeah.
You maybe could handle more, I can only handle one.
Not right now, not at this point in the semester.
Yeah.
Maybe over the summer, or when I retire.
Maybe. A summer's only podcast.
Yeah, right, maybe. I don't know.
So, like I was saying, if you are new to the podcast, it is a trivia podcast. The way that it works is that each week we take turns asking the other person six questions from six different categories that are tied together with a common theme. And the categories are times and places, arts and literature, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. And we talk a little bit about each of the answers. And currently this season, we have done four episodes so far, and we each have accumulated 8 points.
Yes, 8 correct answers apiece.
Correct. So we are tied so far.
Yep.
And today, Justin will be asking the question, so I will be able to get a lead on him, I would hope. Unless I don't get anything, which would be really embarrassing. I don't think that's ever happened.
No, that has never happened.
That would suck.
I think I got one correct answer once. I'm almost certain no one has ever went 0 for 6 in a game.
Yes. We've done 6 for 6, but
a
not
couple
0
of
for
times.
6.
That's pretty uncommon, but it does happen.
Yeah.
So, I don't think you will go 6 for 6 today.
I'm sure I will not.
All right.
Tell us what you got.
Okay, so what I have for you today, Hallie, is a special delivery.
Mail?
It's about the mail, yes.
How thrilling.
Your grandfather would be very disappointed in your sarcasm, considering that your grandfather was a mail carrier for like 30 years or something.
I don't know if he would have said it was thrilling, but, you know, he retired as soon as he could.
Well.
It was pretty grueling, I mean.
Yeah. But, I mean, he was a letter carrier for many years, and it kept food on the table of his family.
And amazing pension.
Yes, correct.
So, there was that.
Yes. All right, so yes, all about the mail and mail carriers and things related to mail. Question one is sports and games. Now a coach at his alma mater, Louisiana Tech, what retired NBA star holds the record for most free throws made and was nicknamed the Mailman for his consistent delivery?
Very good.
Yes.
Was there a time or a date?
I said he was retired and he is now a coach at La Tech, where he went to school.
Got it.
So that narrows it down to he's still alive but not still playing.
That's not helpful.
It's pretty helpful.
I don't know. Larry Bird.
Not a bad guess.
Thanks. It is my default. I have a basketball default. It's Larry Bird.
The mailman was one Karl Malone.
It sounds very vaguely familiar, but I never would have crossed my mind to guess that.
So the main thing to know about Karl Malone, and I'm invalidating the entire discussion I'm about to do, but the main thing to know about him is his nickname was the mailman.
I have a mnemonic.
Okay.
Malone.
Yes.
Malone.
Yes.
Done.
Okay.
I love a good mnemonic.
All right. That being said, Karl Anthony Malone is a retired professional basketball player, a Hall of Famer, an Olympic gold medalist, a businessman, and a man who really likes to refer to himself in the third person. He was very much known for saying, like, this and that Karl Malone. Like, he would just call himself that.
Was he on the Dream Team?
I will get to it, yes.
Okay, I did remember that much.
Yes. He was born in Summerfield, Louisiana on July 24th, 1963, the youngest of 9 children, which is too many.
Way too many.
He played basketball in high school and then went to college at Louisiana Tech, where he led the Bulldogs to the NCAA tournament for the first time in school history.
Where is that?
Louisiana Tech?
Yeah.
It's in Louisiana.
I know that, but I thought maybe we should know where. No?
I don't know the city off the top of my head. Sorry.
Okay.
It's a relatively minor sports school. Like, it's not that big a deal. Like I said, this was the first time they ever went to the tournament. It was when they had Karl Malone, who wound up being one of the greatest basketball players in history. So, like,
right.
You know, they're just not, yeah. He had an offer from, I think, Alabama, but he wanted to stay closer to home, so he went to La Tech.
Okay.
He was drafted by the Utah Jazz, the 13th overall pick in the 1985 NBA draft, which, in hindsight, is insane, considering he ended up being one of the best power forwards in the history of the sport.
It's like the Tom Brady story.
It is not that crazy,
but no.
Yes, it's in that same orbit, yeah. Indeed, Malone himself was so sure that the Dallas Mavericks were going to take him with the 8th overall pick that he had already rented an apartment in Dallas.
Wow.
Whoops.
That sucks.
Yeah. Anyway, he spent the next 18 years with the Jazz, where he and John Stockton made up one of the most feared duos in the league. He was selected as the NBA's most valuable player twice in 1997 and 1999, and went to 14 All-Star games. He was also one of the members of the Dream Team that won Olympic gold in the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona, and he won gold with the American team again in 1996 in Atlanta. Despite all of his accolades, though, he never won an NBA championship. He played his final season with the Los Angeles Lakers in 2003-2004, where he teamed with Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant, and all-star point guard Gary Payton in a clear attempt to finally win a title.
And they just couldn't? That sucks.
They didn't. With such a stacked roster, the Lakers were early favorites to win the championship that year, and they did make it to the finals, but they lost to the Detroit Pistons.
Brutal.
Yes. The mailman retired following that season with zero championships to his name.
Wow.
Incredible. The Jazz retired Malone's number 32 after his retirement, and there are statues of he and Stockton outside of Vivint Arena, the Jazz's home.
Vivint?
Vivint, yes.
Okay.
Stretches of road around the stadium were also renamed, such that the statues now stand at the corner of Malone and Stockton, which I think is pretty cool.
That is cool. I feel like stadium names is one of those things that you should know for trivia, but they're just, I mean, it's just a lot.
Well, by the time you memorize them all, half of them will have changed sponsorships anyway, so.
It's impossible.
Yeah. Malone is known for his physical style of play and his ridiculous durability. Indeed, he was still playing well at the age of 40, becoming the oldest player in NBA history to record a triple-double, which is pretty incredible. He was 40 years old. And
what's
he
a triple-double?
Okay, so in basketball, there are five major categories of statistics for a game. So there's points, assists, rebounds, steals, and another defensive one that I'm not thinking of now.
Okay.
But anyway, so if you hit double digits on three of the major categories in one game, that is a triple-double. It's very uncommon.
Interesting.
It's very hard to do.
I'm sure.
Like, you hear about guys hitting double-doubles a lot, so they'll have, like, you know, double-digit points in a game and double-digit rebounds or whatever, but hitting double digits in three of those categories is very difficult. He did it at the age of 40.
Wow.
He was just a ridiculously durable, ageless athlete. It's crazy.
Yeah.
He also holds the NBA record for the most free throws attempted and made. Today, Malone is on the coaching staff at his alma mater, La Tech. He is an avid hunter and fisherman, a fan of professional wrestling, and the owner of several car dealerships and Jiffy Lube franchises.
Sure.
I mean,
gotta make money.
You gotta make money, right? He had a shitload of money from basketball, and he invested it into things that were gonna bring him back more money. So, I think that's probably what you should do, instead of, like,
yep,
buying a Ferrari or whatever the hell.
Yep.
He and his wife, pageant model Kay Kinsey, have four children, and there are three other children by two other women who are probably his, but paternity has not been definitively established. Do what you will with that.
Does he, like, see them and stuff?
Not very
just,
often.
Or it's just, like, not really?
He does not see them often. He has never legally claimed them as his own, but they are probably his.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Question two is everything else. In the 1860s... the United States Postal Service started issuing what kind of prepaid promissory notes, which are generally more trusted than personal checks, and can also be purchased from Western Union or your local convenience store?
Is it a cashier's check?
Is that your answer?
I don't know. A money order? Fuck, I don't know. It's one or the other. Shit. I'm so bad at this. I went to the post office when we had to pay the rent to get a... oh, I mix them up. I feel like they're two different things. You could either, the moving companies are always like, you can give us a cashier's check or a money order. But I feel like the grocery store one, oh, God damn it, I'm going to pick the wrong one. I don't know, cashier's check. Like a grocery store has a cashier. I don't know.
Is that your answer?
I don't know, sure. I don't know.
Only banks issue cashier's checks. You can buy money orders.
God at the damn post office. It.
I thought you were going to get there. You will not mix them up again after this. So a while back, I said that we should talk about alternative payment methods besides cash, checks, and credit cards at some point. And today, the time has come. To start, there are so many kinds of check. Personal checks are the most familiar, the things in the checkbook that the bank gives you when you open an account. A personal check is essentially a promise made by an account holder that when the recipient cashes it, there will be enough money in the account to cover the amount of the check. The problem, of course, is that the account holder could just, you know, lie, and the check would bounce. So there are other more secure forms. For example, a cashier's check is guaranteed by the bank, because the funds are withdrawn from the account when it is issued, and they are held by the bank, and the check is signed by a cashier, hence the term. So when you get a cashier's check, the bank withdraws the money from your account right then, and holds it in, like, its own little account.
Oh, I got a cashier's check when I closed out my bank account.
That is correct, yes.
I did all that stuff at once, so I guess I got it
yes,
mixed up.
Yes, that's right. So, as you said, moving companies prefer money orders, but our first month's rent here had to be by cashier's check for some reason.
So confusing.
Which was really weird, but anyway. So basically, the bank holds the money so that the account holder can't go spend it before the check is cashed, right? Which you could do with a personal check. A cashier's check is not the same as a certified check, in which the bank verifies that sufficient funds are in the account to cover the promised amount at the time that it is issued, but does not withdraw the money and therefore does not guarantee the funds. So the distinction there is a little bit subtle. Did you follow that? Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. So a cashier's check, the bank takes the money out of the account the moment it's issued, so that when the check is cashed, the bank is holding that money, right? A certified check, they verify that there is enough money in the account to cover the check when it is issued, but they do not then withdraw it. So you still cash a certified check the same way as a personal check.
So it's just, like, confirmed more than a personal check?
Yeah, well, so with a personal check, you could just write it and just say, yep, I totally have this $1,000 in my checking account. Uh-huh. Don't you even worry about it, buddy, right? With a certified check, it's the bank saying, yes, they have this $1,000 right this moment, but as soon as the certified check is issued, you could then go withdraw the $1,000.
So you might as well get a cashier's check if you're trying to be secure like that.
Well, I think this is why you don't hear about certified checks very often.
Yeah.
Because they're really not that much more secure than a personal check. You know, I mean, they have this guarantee from the bank that the money's there right now, but it might not be in 5 minutes. You know, that's the problem. So this is why the banks don't guarantee the funds of a certified check, but they do a cashier's check. There are also traveler's checks, or rather there were, because no one uses them anymore. They were basically fixed amount checks that would be honored as long as the original signature matched the signature of the person trying to redeem it. They were mainly used by people on vacation, hence the term, so that they didn't have to carry large amounts of cash. Nowadays, of course, almost all major credit cards can be used internationally with no problem, so... Money orders are somewhat similar, but they are technically not checks because they are not tied to a particular bank account. Instead, a person pays for the money order in cash, and the company that issues it guarantees payment, which is why they're more trusted than personal checks.
Why don't you just pay cash?
Well, you could, but especially for large amounts, you don't want to be making large transactions in cash, you know? So,
okay.
Like, the moving companies, they don't want a personal check. Because they're not going to trust it, because it might bounce, right? So they want to make sure that, you know, they're getting the money. But you don't want to just give a mover, an employee of a moving company, $500 in cash, right?
So the time I did pay cash, it was because that guy owned the company.
That's right. So, you know, what could happen is the money order, you would make it out to a particular recipient, which is the name of the company, right? And so if you just gave an employee $500 cash, they could just pocket it and go to their boss and say, oh, no, sorry, man, they never paid me, right? Like,
right.
I told them to, and they just stiffed me, right? So, like, that's what a money order secures. So that's why they have the clients go to the post office or Western Union or MoneyGram or Walmart or 7-Eleven or whatever, pay cash for the money order, and then make the money order out to the business and then give it to the employee. That's what they're good for.
Okay.
Yeah. But those are all old and mostly out of use now. Cashier's checks are still used in real estate transactions and the like, and money orders are sometimes used to pay small businesses, like we said. But all of these financial technologies are being supplanted by more modern, more electronic alternatives. First, there are wire transfers. This is a transfer of funds directly from one bank to another. These are actually pretty old. Western Union first started wire transfers in 1872, when they sent messages over their transcontinental telegraph system from one bank to another.
Who founded Western Union?
Well, I don't know all of them, but I know one of the founders of Western Union was Ezra Cornell, also the founder of our alma mater, which we did not know until a week ago.
No one tells you that when you go to Cornell. I don't know why.
That was on The Weakest Link, right? It was Ivy League school was named after one of the founders of Western Union.
And we were like, well, we know it's not
right,
Cornell.
Well, it's not Cornell. It probably wasn't John Harvard founding Western Union. It's probably Dartmouth. That sounds like it's named for a person. And then it was Cornell. And we were like, what the fuck? No one told us this.
And Dartmouth isn't named for a person?
I don't think it is, because I looked it up and I'm pretty sure it's not.
So confusing.
Yeah. Anyway, that was off track. So yeah, Western Union started doing wire transfers where they would, allow banks to communicate with each other over their telegraph lines in the 1870s. And so this is actually where the term wire transfer comes from, right? The first wire transfers were literally sent over telegraph wires. Nowadays, though, most payments that aren't made by credit card or in cash are made via electronic funds transfer, or EFT, of one kind or another. Modern wire transfers are EFTs. They're not sent over telegraphs anymore, obviously. They're done over the internet. EFTs also include direct deposits and direct debits, which are usually called electronic checks or e-checks in the US, bank payments or bank transfers in the UK, e-transfers in Canada, and, for whatever reason, gyro transfers in continental Europe.
Fun. What's Zelle?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
But not gyro like the sandwich. G-I-R-O. I don't know. I don't understand what that
Euro?
Means. Euro? Yeah, maybe. But
I'm
no.
Kidding.
No.
Joke.
I don't know. I don't understand where that term comes from. It's very strange. More recently, instant payments have been developed, which allow for near instantaneous transfer from one bank account to another. In the US, Zelle and Venmo are the most common platforms for this kind of thing. Although Venmo is not just an instant payments platform, it is also a mobile wallet, which is a form of payment in which people can transfer money directly between people using their mobile phones. Mobile payments are pretty much revolutionizing personal finance, especially in developing countries. Roughly half the adult population on Earth are unbanked, meaning that they do not have access to financial institutions, but mobile payments are democratizing financial transactions. And speaking of democratizing, of course, the new kid on the financial block is cryptocurrency. I've spoken about Bitcoin specifically in the past, but crypto goes far beyond the brainchild of the mysterious Mr. Satoshi Nakamoto. Cryptocurrencies are not usually considered to be actual currency, in that they are not backed by a government or bank, but no one really seems to agree on what they actually are. They have been variously categorized as securities or commodities, neither of which really seems quite right. They're pretty much an anonymous, extremely volatile something that can be used to pay for drugs, guns, or people over the dark web and convert it back to real money at will. Or they're the future of commerce. It depends on who you ask.
Yeah, I'm not messing with that yet.
I mean, they're mostly used for dark web transactions still. Well, I mean, there's investors investing in them and speculating
on
them.
But I feel like a lot of people I know who have some money have invested in it just because they can.
But, they're highly volatile, and they're not really anything.
Maybe, for the fun of the volatility?
Maybe.
Don't know.
I guess if you're a risk-taking type. But, I mean, they're not really backed by anything. So, I mean, that's the problem with them. And, again, they are primarily used to buy illegal guns and drugs on the dark web. So, at some point, governments are going to step in and regulate or outright ban them. So, I don't think those investments are going to last long term anyway. But, what the fuck do I know? Nothing. All right, question 3, music. What band's song, Across the Sea, was inspired by a letter sent to frontman Rivers Cuomo from a fan in Japan?
Rivers Cuomo. I don't know. I'm going to just rip off the Band-Aid here. I think it's Weezer.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
Rivers Cuomo is the front man of Weezer.
Yay! Yes, correct. I didn't finish the first half with nothing. That's good.
Yes. So Weezer are an American rock band formed in Los Angeles in 1992. Rivers Cuomo, by far the most trivia-relevant member of the band, moved to L.A. from Connecticut in 1989 with his high school metal band, Avant Garde.
Is yes. Rivers his real name?
Yes.
That's weird.
It is.
Like, River Phoenix.
Also weird.
But the plural seems weirder somehow.
I agree. Both weird. So, Rivers moved to L.A. with his high school metal band, Avant Garde, later called Zoom, not to be confused with the video chat app of the same name, of course.
No one is confusing that.
Okay, good. Zoom broke up, and Cuomo was briefly in a band called Fuzz, and then 60 Wrong Sausages. These are all terrible band names.
Oy.
Awful. Cuomo relocated to Santa Monica, where he recorded dozens of demos, and formed Weezer with drummer Patrick Wilson, bassist Matt Sharp, and guitarist Jason Cropper. While they were recording their first album, Cropper was fired and replaced with Brian Bell. What?
Nothing. I was like, Patrick Wilson, and I like had a face in my head, and I was like, why am I picturing this person named Patrick Wilson? So I Googled Patrick Wilson, so there's also an actor named Patrick Wilson, and I just can't help myself. I like knowing actors' names and their faces because you just never know when it's going to come up, and it sometimes does, and I was right, and that's him if you want to know.
Okay.
You can Google it.
I don't care. So anyway, in 1994, they released their first album, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the Blue Album for reasons that will become clear shortly.
Okay.
The Blue Album features the singles Undone, the Sweater Song, Buddy Holly, and Say It Ain't So, and established the band's unique blend of alternative rock, geeky humor, and radio-worthy hooks. It is certified quadruple platinum and remains Weezer's best-selling album.
I love Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly is great.
I like Say It Ain't So. Yeah. I don't know the third one.
Undone, the Sweater Song? Yeah, I didn't.
I probably would know if I heard it.
Probably, yeah.
I love Buddy Holly, though.
Buddy Holly is really good, yeah. Cuomo's original idea for their next album was a sci-fi rock opera called Songs from the Black Hole, intended to be a meditation on his ambivalent attitude towards success. He ended up enrolling at Harvard and abandoning the idea.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yes, he went to Harvard. Weezer's eventual second album, Pinkerton, was released in 1996, and its darker sound was initially unpopular. It was voted as one of the worst albums of the year. It is now widely considered one of the greatest albums of all time.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm. It included Across the Sea, which I mentioned in the question, though it is,
I don't think I know that.
It's not one of their, like, most well-known songs. It is better known for the singles El Scorcho, The Good Life, and Pink Triangle.
Nope.
Nope. Sharp left the band after Pinkerton, and Weezer went on hiatus. They came back together in 1998, replacing Sharp with Mikey Welsh, but then Wilson briefly left the band. They played a couple of shows without him under the name Goat Punishment, which is...
Wow.
Awful?
Weezer is so much better than all these. Not that Weezer is such a great name, but compared to all these, it is.
Goat Punishment.
Oi, not good.
That just sounds...
Why?
That just makes my skin crawl.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. Cuomo's recurring struggles with depression were also especially bad around this time. It seemed like Weezer might be doomed. They weren't. They released their third studio album in 2000, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the Green Album for reasons that are becoming clear.
They just named multiple albums Weezer?
Oh, buckle the fuck up.
Oh, God.
It is known for the singles Hash Pipe, Island in the Sun, and Photograph.
I like Island in the Sun.
Yeah.
Photograph is okay, but I really like Island in the Sun. I don't know.
Photograph is better than the Nickelback song of the same title.
That is true,
but that's
but
not
I really
a high
like
bar.
Island in the Sun. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's different from their other stuff. Not that I dislike their other stuff. It's just different.
Yeah.
I like it.
Welsh left the band in 2001 and was replaced by Scott Schreiner. The lineup of Cuomo, Wilson, Bell, and Schreiner persists to this day. So 20 plus years.
Wow.
They've had the same lineup.
They
now.
Found
the right alchemy, yeah.
Yeah.
Their fourth album, 2002's Maladroit, and their fifth, 2005's Make Believe, received mixed reviews. They took a more experimental approach for their sixth album, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the Red Album, for reasons
guess...
that you are now catching on to.
I was going to guess Red. Why? I was going to guess Red. How weird is that?
Yeah. It is primarily known for the single Pork and Beans.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't know that one. 2009's Ratitude and 2010's Hurley were more popular and less rock-oriented than previous outings and received mixed reviews.
Was that the soundtrack for Ratatouille?
No.
Oh.
No, it was not.
Okay.
Okay. They returned to their rock roots with their 9th album, Everything Will Be All Right in the End, and their 10th, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the White Album.
White?
For reasons that are now obvious.
You can't do White. That's the Beatles. You could do, what was missing? Yellow?
There is no Yellow album. There's still a couple more coming, but there's no Yellow.
But they shouldn't do White of all colors. Come on.
I mean, it's not like a blank white like the Beatles' White Album.
Sure.
It's just all of these self-titled Weezer albums are just a picture of the band against a colored background, basically.
That's kind of cool, but also insane.
I agree. These albums were better received than their immediate predecessors. So Everything Will Be All Right in the End and the White Album got better reviews than the previous ones because they went back to more of their rock sound that they had before. They tried pop again with 2017's Pacific Daydream. In 2019, they released a surprise album consisting entirely of covers, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the Teal Album for reasons.
Teal.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It is particularly notable for a cover of Toto's Africa.
It's pretty good. Not as good as the original. Have you heard it?
Yeah.
It's not as good as the original.
It's fine.
It's fine. Yeah.
You know I don't like that song anyway, so.
How? How do you not like it?
Because it's bad.
It's like one of the best songs.
Okay.
I love that song.
That same year, 2019, they released their 13th album, the self-titled Weezer, which fans usually refer to as the Black Album because it is known for the single Can't Knock the Hustle. In 2021, they released OK Human, which featured an orchestral pop sound, and Van Weezer, which was mainly influenced by hard rock, especially Van Halen.
They released two albums last year?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, in 2019, too. The Teal Album and the Black Album both came out in 2019.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're just picking back up.
Yeah. Currently, they are in the middle of a 4-part cycle of EPs inspired by the four seasons. SZNS Spring, so Seasons Spring, was released in 2022, with Summer, Autumn, Winter, and the 7th self-titled Weezer presumably coming soon.
It kind of makes you want to be like a huge fan of a band, like to follow this kind of stuff, but I'm just not.
I do not care enough.
I don't care enough about any musician. I hate to say that, but I just don't.
No, I'm with you though.
But it does seem cool to be like, wow, like the seasons and let's wait for the next one. I don't know. It sounds cool, but like I just can't.
Yeah.
I would say of all the things, I'm a musical theater
person. You are. Yes.
Like, I have, like, a musical theater person that I follow their album and stuff. And they're coming out with a 44-track album next month, so buckle up.
God help me.
It's going to be ridiculous.
No.
If you're into that kind of thing, I will make a plug. His name is Joe Iconis. His musicals are great. His songs are great. He was my camp counselor as a child, so I actually know him personally. But I didn't know that when I discovered his music, and that was pretty crazy. That was a crazy story.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, if you like musical theater stuff and you like sci-fi or genre or weird stuff, right up your alley.
And if you don't like musical theater stuff, feel my pain.
Oh, please. You like a lot of his stuff.
A lot of it is pretty good.
Yes.
All right. Weezer have a lot of self-titled albums is the takeaway here.
I got that.
Yeah.
And they have some good songs.
They do. Buddy Holly's great.
And Island in the Sun.
Yeah.
Islands? Island?
Island.
Island. Okay. All right, and on that note, we will bring you to halftime. Thank you all for listening. We appreciate it, and we would love to hear from you. If you would like to leave us a rating and or review, that would be really cool. We would love to read that. And we would also like to hear from you if you want to reach out or just follow us. We're on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Quiz and Hers. If you want to actually like see content, that's usually from Twitter.
Mostly, yeah.
Not so much on the others.
No.
But you can get your like episode updates and whatever.
Well, we have a lot more followers on Twitter than anywhere else, so that's mostly where I'm active.
But you also have the most followers on Twitter because you're the most active.
Yeah, it's a real snake eating its tail situation, isn't it?
Yes, but it's also easier to be active for us on Twitter because we're not like a photo-based thing. So it's like, I don't know what to post photos of. So that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
So if you want, you can reach out to us through those, or you can just send us an email at quizandhers@gmail.com. And we really appreciate getting the emails from our few fans that have emailed us, and we would love to hear more. That would be super cool. And as we always say, we are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. You can go to bigheadsmedia.com to check out our merch and some other podcasts, and everything is kind of there, like localized in one place. So go to bigheadsmedia.com and check out some stuff there. And if you want to hear about another great podcast, just keep listening.
Time for an ad.
Yep.
Hi, everyone. This is Clint.
This is Ross.
This is Joel.
This is Cutter.
This is Tony.
From Three Beers In.
A proud member of Big Heads Media Network.
Each episode we review local Austin craft beer and talk about
Clove and Bananas.
References I don't get. And Academy Award winner Matthew McConaughey.
So tune in,
crack open a beer,
and hang out with us.
Find us on bigheadsmedia.com, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify,
or on threebeersinpodcast.com.
This is the podcast.
All right, we're back.
All right. Question four is arts and literature. What American artist painted Postman Reading Mail, as well as over 300 other cover illustrations for the Saturday Evening Post?
I feel like we've talked about this, but I should just go with my gut. Norman Rockwell?
It is Norman Rockwell, and I don't think we've talked about him.
That's weird. I have like a weird you know, you ever get a weird feeling like we talked about something? We probably didn't. I just, you know, deja vu or something.
So I just double-checked, and no, the only Rockwell we have spoken about so far is actor Sam Rockwell, who is great.
Yep.
But
okay, maybe he just came up.
Maybe. So, Norman Percival Rockwell.
Come on, should have gone by Percival.
Incredible, yep. Was born on February 3rd, 1894 in New York City, a descendant of a very early English settler named John Rockwell. So he could, like, trace his heritage, not quite to the Mayflower, but like to around that time period.
Wow.
He studied art from an early age, transferring out of high school to the Chase Art School at the age of 14, followed by the National Academy of Design and the Art Students League. After his education, he was hired as a staff artist for the Boy Scouts of America's magazine Boys Life, beginning a lifelong association with the BSA. At the age of 19, he was promoted to art editor of the magazine, a post he held for 3 years. It was during this period, in 1913, that he published his first magazine cover, Scout at Ship's Wheel. When he was 21, he moved with his family to New Rochelle, New York, where he turned his attention to painting rather than illustrating. He sold his first cover painting to the Saturday Evening Post, titled Mother's Day Off, in 1916. 8 of the Post's covers during the next year were Rockwell paintings, so he was just off and running. He sold his first one, and then 7 more in the next year.
Wow.
Yeah. And he eventually contributed 323 cover paintings to the Saturday Evening Post.
Crazy.
Ridiculous. He left his salaried job at Boys Life when he started working with the Post, but he continued his association with the Boy Scouts. His paintings for their annual calendars are particularly notable. He joined the Navy during World War I, but never saw action because he was assigned to be a military artist, whatever that means. During World War II, he was inspired by Franklin Roosevelt's speech, The Four Freedoms, and painted works depicting each of the freedoms Franklin had articulated as universal human rights. The pieces, Freedom from Want, Freedom of Speech, Freedom of Worship, and Freedom from Fear, were published, where else, in the Saturday Evening Post. And the originals were exhibited around the country to get people to buy war bonds.
Interesting.
Yeah. In 1943, the same year he completed the Four Freedoms series, a fire in his studio destroyed several original works, but also, more importantly, many of the costumes and props he had his models use in his paintings of old-timey Americana. They were irreplaceable, so he shifted his focus to depicting more modern subjects. His last cover painting for the Post was a portrait of Egyptian politician Gamal Abdel Nasser, published in May 1963.
That Nasser?
Yes.
Okay.
A few years before he became president. Though the last one to be printed was a reprint of his portrait of President John F. Kennedy, which had been the cover of the April 1963 issue, and was reprinted in December after Kennedy's assassination.
Wow.
Yeah. Rockwell's last piece for the Boy Scouts was The Spirit of 1976, which he completed at the age of 82. His association with the BSA produced a total of 471 images across various publications. Rockwell died of emphysema at the age of 84 on November 8, 1978. In his own lifetime, Rockwell was derided by art critics for his idealistic works, which they called banal and bourgeois, and many refused to even acknowledge him as an artist, dismissing him merely as an illustrator. Remember, he was working during the same time period as Dali and Picasso, so...
It is a little less art-y, yeah, I get that.
You can sort of see their point.
Yeah, but like, just because Dali and Picasso weren't portraitists, like, in that way, doesn't mean he wasn't an artist. Like, if he was earlier than that, then he just would have been an artist.
Well, that's right. Despite this, he remains well-known today, and his technical skill as an artist is unquestioned.
Yeah.
In addition to Kennedy and Nasser, he also painted portraits of such luminaries as Presidents Eisenhower, Johnson, and Nixon, Judy Garland, and of all people, Colonel Sanders. So yes, there exists a Norman Rockwell portrait of Colonel Harlan Sanders, which is amazing.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. He is also known for his character, Private Willie Gillis.
His character?
Yeah, this Willie Gillis was a private in the military that appeared in a lot of his illustrations. He was sort of a stand-in for, like, the everyman soldier.
Was he a real person, or he made him up?
No, he made him up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's also famous for his image of Rosie the Riveter. It's not the one you're thinking of. That one is by Howard Miller.
So there's another portrait? Oh, I have to look that up.
Well, Rosie was a character.
But that's interesting that, like, there was more.
Oh, she was everywhere. She was such a propaganda symbol during the war. So the one on your shirt, that's Howard Miller.
I'm currently wearing
her Rosie shirt. That's just a coincidence.
I think it's almost time for a new one.
Do you think so? It's in shambles.
This is my second one.
I know. Hallie loves her some Rosie the Riveter.
I do.
But yeah, so Rockwell has an image of her as well, his interpretation of her. And he is also known for The Problem We All Live With, his iconic image of Ruby Bridges, flanked by U.S. Marshals on her way to integrate William France Elementary School in New Orleans. So not everything he produced was meritless saccharine garbage, only 99% of it.
That's not nice.
It's true. I mean, the art critics were not wrong.
I mean, sure, I guess. You have to... He was filling a niche.
I guess. All right. Question 5 is movies and TV. The recurring character Newman is a mailman and the nemesis of the titular character of what American sitcom?
Newman. Sorry.
Newman.
Is that how does he say it?
Newman.
Newman. Seinfeld.
Hello, Newman.
Hello, Newman.
Yes, it's Seinfeld.
I know it is. We should watch it, but it's also a lot. I could watch it, though. It's weird, because everybody says that you shouldn't binge The Office because it's too awkward.
Mm-hmm.
However, I did binge The Office. I watched like 9 seasons in less than a week.
I know.
But I find that with Seinfeld that it's too much for me.
It's not that it's awkward, it's just they're just the fucking worst.
Yeah. Do you like it?
Yeah, I do.
Would you watch it?
Sure.
Would you watch Curb? I like Curb.
I like Curb.
I like Curb a lot.
Okay.
I don't know why I don't mind that, but I do mind Seinfeld.
I don't know.
I don't dislike it, it's just... I can't get through that many episodes, like one episode a day.
Okay. So, Seinfeld is widely considered to be one of the greatest sitcoms in American television history.
Agree to disagree.
It aired on NBC in the 1990s, and it is very quintessentially 1990s. It was created by Jerry Seinfeld, who stars as a fictionalized version of himself, a struggling comedian and minor celebrity in New York City, along with Larry David, who served as showrunner for most of the show's run, and later went on to create and star in Curb Your Enthusiasm, you've talked about before.
It's so good. It's very funny.
It is. Besides Seinfeld the actor playing Seinfeld the character, the main cast of Seinfeld the show included Jason Alexander as Jerry's best friend George Costanza.
He's great.
Yes. Julie Louis-Dreyfus as his ex-girlfriend turned close friend, sometimes with benefits, Elaine Bennis.
She's also great. We should talk about Veep, or we should talk about her. She won, like, Emmys every single year. It's a great show.
She's very good. And Michael Richards as his eccentric neighbor, Cosmo Kramer.
We don't talk about that. We're just not going to get into that.
He's a bad dude.
Bad dude.
George was based on Larry David himself, while Elaine was sort of an amalgam of Seinfeld and David's girlfriends from their early days as comedians.
Amalgamation?
Yeah.
Amalgam?
Oh, it's the same thing.
Hmm.
And Kramer was actually based on a real neighbor of Larry David's.
That's crazy.
Which is amazing.
It is. Can you imagine?
No. As I mentioned in the question, Wayne Knight also had a recurring role as Newman, Jerry's arch nemesis and a friend of Kramer's.
What else is he known for besides Jurassic Park?
Mostly Seinfeld and Jurassic Park. He's in a bunch of stuff, but he's always been like just a character actor, you know? He's never been like a leading guy.
He was very funny in that show.
Yeah. The show was originally titled The Seinfeld Chronicles for its first 5-episode season, and its chances of getting renewed seemed slim because it didn't do well with audiences, despite enthusiasm from the studio executives and from critics.
I mean, it's a show about nothing.
It isn't. It was renewed, though, and the ratings slowly rose. The show is often described as being about nothing, but this was actually just a joke from the season 4 story arc in which Jerry and George tried to develop a show within the show called Jerry in a metafictional gag.
And then in Curb, they also try to create a show. It's all kind of...
They do the Seinfeld revival in Curb, yes.
It's very fun.
Yeah. So Jerry is a sitcom that they pitch within Seinfeld based on the four of them. And
very clever.
The whole idea is it's a show about nothing. And they go to the network executives, and it's like, well, if I ask you what's the show about, what do you say? Nothing. It's about nothing. Apparently, though, the actual original pitch by Seinfeld and David was that the show was about the mundane everyday events that give comedians their material. So it's not about nothing. It's about the humor in everyday life.
Yeah. Like, it's about things that happen normally, but they would never show on a TV show because it's not supposed to be funny, but it really is.
Right. They find the humor in the mundane.
Yeah.
Yeah. The show ultimately ran for 9 seasons and topped the Nielsen ratings in seasons 6 and 9. NBC offered Jerry $100 million to do a 10th season, but he declined because he believed that the quality would drop off if the show continued.
That's very...
That's a commitment to your craft.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only 2 other sitcoms in history, I Love Lucy and The Andy Griffith Show, went out when they were on top of the ratings.
I talked about The Andy Griffith Show.
You did.
Wait, what about Schitt's Creek? Does that count?
No, that was never on top of the Nielsen ratings. What are you talking about?
But I mean, okay, but they kind of left on top because as soon as their last season came out, everyone was watching it, but it was on streaming. I
mean, literally the most watched show in the Nielsen ratings.
Oh, I see. Like the top.
The number one show in the country.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, so it shares this distinction of quite literally going out on top with only I Love Lucy and The Andy Griffith Show.
Good for them. Shows are always better when they leave before they've jumped the shark.
Agreed. Seinfeld has been remarkably influential on American culture. It introduced and or popularized a ton of common sayings, including yada, yada, yada. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I'm sorry, what?
What?
The only reason we say not that there's anything wrong with that is because of Seinfeld?
The episode is called The Outing, and
what?
Someone erroneously outs George and Jerry as a gay couple, and they spend the rest of the episode trying to convince everyone that they're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Oh my God, that just blew my mind.
Yes.
Okay, we have to watch that one. That's crazy.
Oh, there's more. So yada, yada, yada. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Shrinkage.
Yep.
Regift.
Okay, that's crazy, though, that they made that up. Wow.
Well, I'm not sure if they completely originated all of these, but they certainly popularized them.
Okay.
And double dip, among many others.
Are you a double dipper?
You double dipped a chip. The show is also notable for breaking several sitcom conventions of the time. Unusually, it does not revolve around a family or a workplace, but rather a close-knit group of friends. That wasn't really a big thing in the early 90s. It sort of pioneered that idea.
This was like 5 years before Friends.
About that, yes.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. It resisted the impulse to develop a romantic plot line between Jerry and Elaine, something that Larry David decided very early on would never happen.
Something that pretty much no other sitcom has ever done.
Exactly.
Well, I don't think.
That's what I'm saying.
Not
is that
I can
like,
think of. I can't think of one.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying, is it's breaking a lot of the conventions. So it didn't develop the romantic plot line. It was not about a workplace or a family.
But my point is, like, they still have shows now that are about friend groups, but I would say they don't have shows since then where there's not a romantic thing. at all.
Yeah.
That does not happen.
No.
That's pretty cool.
And the characters are simply awful people who never learn or grow, which was referred to as the no hugging, no learning rule on set.
So they were like totally aware of this.
Oh, they knew.
Wow.
This was the whole concept, was that they were just like remorseless bastards just floating through the world.
I feel like there's another show you say that about, but I can't think of what.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia,
which you talked about.
Which is definitely
heavily
influenced by Seinfeld.
Yeah, but they're way worse.
Sunny is much more in your face about it.
Yeah.
But, like,
it's a different kind of thing. Like, Seinfeld is a little more, like, I don't know if passive aggressive is the word, but, like, they try to convince you and each other that they're not bad.
No, they don't.
I don't know what
they
the difference. There's a difference. There's a difference. I don't know what it is.
People in Seinfeld are driven by their insecurities. People in Sunny are driven by their baser instincts. That's the difference.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's fair.
You could write a dissertation on that. Someone can grab
I'm sure someone has.
Whoever's listening to the show, you can have that thesis for free. Just put me in the acknowledgments, all right?
I'm sure that's been,
I got you.
That's been written, for sure.
Fittingly, the show's finale ends with the four main characters going to jail. Some of the more well-known episodes include the Chinese restaurant, in which the main cast just sit waiting for a table for the entire episode.
Pretty good.
That's real. The Soup Nazi, about the titular persnickety restaurateur. And the contest, in which the four main characters see who can go the longest without masturbating.
That's a good one. My friends in high school did that.
Yeah, I know. You've told me.
Yep.
The latter in particular was controversial, and the content was considered inappropriate for a primetime sitcom. So the word masturbation is never actually uttered in the episode.
It's very good.
Instead, various oblique euphemisms like being master of your domain are used instead. A lot of Seinfeld probably hasn't aged very well, but I remember it being very funny in its time. I grew up watching it with my dad. It was every night during the week. It was Simpsons reruns at 8 and Seinfeld reruns at 8:30.
Wow.
Every day. And I remember it being really funny. A lot of it went over my head because I was like 5.
Yeah, but, I'm sure.
But the I remember of it, the more I'm like, oh, that's actually really good. It's
I
very
like
clever.
The Ugly Baby.
That one's very funny. The Bubble Boy is classic, of course.
Yes. I like Festivus.
Festivus is great, yep.
And I like the puffy shirt.
Yeah, but I don't want to be a pirate.
It's a good one.
So funny. Jerry Seinfeld, you're not very cool anymore, but it was a very good show.
Oh, but Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee is fun.
Okay.
I like it.
All right.
I recommend.
All right. All right. Question the sixth. Times and places. Arguably more famous than it was historically significant, what mail service promised delivery from Missouri to California in 10 days, but shut down in 1861 after just 18 months when the first transcontinental telegraph made it obsolete?
I think I talked about this. I didn't talk about the topic. I think I mentioned this in another topic.
All right.
Which is helpful. Is it the Pony Express?
Yes, it is. When would this have come up before?
Oh, well, I talked about the horse library.
The horse library.
Yeah.
That sounds like an episode of Seinfeld. What the fuck are you talking about?
Look it up when I talked about the library ladies that used to take the books. The Pack Horse Library Project.
Okay. Yes. Not the same thing as the Pony Express.
I know, but I feel like I mentioned that in there because it was like a thing.
Maybe.
That was a good one. That was an interesting story.
Yes. So, the Pony Express is incredibly famous, and it is romanticized as a symbol of the rugged American frontier spirit. So, I always sort of assumed that it operated for, like, 20 years during the entire Old West period. I was surprised to learn that it actually only existed for about a year and a half, and it never once turned a profit. It just isn't all that historically important. But it is trivia important, mostly because it is so romanticized.
It's so weird how certain things are just not that important to history, but are super important for trivia. Like, how did these things become just trivia fodder?
Canon. Yeah, trivia canon. I don't know. I think in this case, it's because it has such a mystique about it. Like, it's so mythologized, even though it really didn't matter that much in the grand scheme of things. It just has that, like, Old West rugged pioneer spirit, I guess, you know?
It's guess so.
Strapping young lads, riding horses at full gallop, it makes for good cinema.
They should make a show about that.
it'd be really fucking boring. It'd just be guys riding all day and then sleeping and then getting up and doing it again and delivering mail. Like,
hot.
I don't want to watch that.
Women want to watch
that. Maybe.
I'm kidding.
Shonda Rhimes can do her first Western piece.
Yeah, there you go.
Ugh, God, that sounds awful. Anyway, so the population in California boomed after the gold rush in 1848, and California entered the Union as a free state in 1850. On the eve of the Civil War, California was a prosperous state, but it was largely cut off from the rest of the country because it took forever to get mail across the mostly uninhabited territories between Missouri and California. So, just like now, no one lives between St. Louis and, like, Las Vegas. Sorry, flyover states, but there's a reason people call you flyover states.
Colorado.
Yeah,
Denver.
Denver's a thing.
Boulder. Aspen.
All right, skiing is a thing. You're right.
Skiing is a thing.
Fine, fair enough.
Yeah.
Arizona's pretty nice. I've been there.
I've heard.
William Russell, Alexander Majors, and William B. Waddell were businessmen who saw the need to connect California to the rest of the nation, and they conceived of the idea of the Pony Express. They set up the business in just 2 months, and operations began on April 3rd, 1860. Pony Express riders were young men who could weigh no more than 125 pounds so as not to weigh down their mounts.
Less hot.
Yeah, it's not the big strapping cowboys you're imagining. It's like scrawny little guys like I was in high school. Like, I could have been a Pony Express rider in high school if I knew how to ride horses and was not in high school.
And lived in, what was the year?
The 1860s. 1860 right. to 1861.
Okay.
Right. I suppose that's the major.
So close, yeah. And yet over 100 years too far.
All right, you're fine. I suppose that is probably the primary reason I could not do this.
Probably.
All right. The horses were small, fast creatures, hence the Pony Express. They actually were quite small. It turns out a horse can run at top speed on flat ground for about 10 miles before it just can't keep going. So, Pony Express stations were placed about 10 miles apart. Riders would go from one station to the next at full gallop, change to a new horse, and keep going. Riders went about 75 miles in a day before passing off the mail they were carrying to a new rider, and they went day and night.
Imagine being that guy whose horse is just like, not after 5 miles.
I mean, I think these horses were specifically
trained.
Selected
uh-huh.
for having the physical capacity to do this.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I can't even run 1 mile, so...
No, me neither. There were a total of 190 Pony Express stations, mostly swing stations where riders just switched mounts. Others were called home stations. This is where the riders could eat and sleep. So when you got to the end of your run for a day, you would stop at a home station, pass off your parcel to the next guy, get a hot meal and a bed, then you'd get up and you'd do it again. So, riders carried nothing with them except for a water pouch, a revolver, and a mochila, the pouch in which they carried the mail.
Wait, how did they get back home?
So, they didn't go all the way from Missouri to California. Like, each rider was responsible for certain stretches, and so, like, you'd
go
one
between...
direction one day and then back the next day, I think.
So, you probably lived in one of them.
Presumably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, I didn't write this down, but they were shockingly well paid, these guys. They made $125 a month.
Wow.
A typical semi-skilled laborer at the time, like a bricklayer or something like that, or a mason, made like $2 a day. So, I mean, they're basically making
twice
like...
twice as much.
Yeah, these Pony Express riders, they're basically making twice what a skilled artisan made at the time. So, like, you know, these businessmen, Russell, Majors, and Waddell, like, they were fucking serious about this. Like, they put a ton of money into this.
There's a TV show in there.
I think the TV show would have to focus on the intrigue of the business.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it would be about the rich guys running this, which, again,
but also,
there's
like,
enough
what
shows about rich people.
But also, they're getting rich from doing it, so, like, what are they doing with all this money that they're making?
Oh, they are not. I told you, it never turned a profit. Not once.
But...
they lost a shitload of money.
But they're paying them $125 a month.
Oh, you mean the riders
yeah.
are making... Oh, yeah, no, that's true. You could do... yeah, that would be an interesting show, I guess,
yeah,
maybe.
That's what I'm saying.
All right.
Well, that's why they weren't turning a profit. They were paying their employees too much.
Well.
More than they could afford.
You had to pay them a lot, because this was grueling fucking work. I mean, this was 10-hour days, back-to-back.
I'm not saying they're overpaid. I'm saying probably the business owners couldn't afford to pay them that much.
Well, I'll tell you why they thought they'd be able to in the long run. They were wrong, but I'll tell you why they thought they could. So, they were paying these kids. I mean, they were kids. They were young. They were paying them so much because this was dangerous, grueling work. I mean, it was 10 hours a day out in the blistering hot sun at full gallop, and riding out in the uninhabited fucking desert of the American West at the time was not the safest thing you could do. You know, there's a reason they all carried revolvers.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So anyway, Russell, Majors, and Waddell planned to reduce the delivery time from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento, California to 10 days, which many others at the time considered flat-out impossible. They succeeded anyway. The first westbound and eastbound trips both made it in 10 days.
Cool.
So they left on April 3rd, 1860. They arrived 10 days later on April 14th, 1860, or April 13th. One was 13th, one was 14th, but it was still like less than 11 days because of the start times. So 10 days technically.
That does seem fast for the time.
Oh, incredibly. I mean, again, they were riding full gallop constantly. Like, you know, even when you got to the home station, you just passed it off to the next guy and he would go for 10 hours.
What do you think people were sending? Just like, hey, what's up? In California?
So I don't think it was that, but I will tell you that whatever it was only fucking rich people.
I'm
so
sure.
The original price to send mail via the Pony Express was $10 per ounce, which was 25,000% more expensive than the U.S. mail.
That's insane.
Yes.
No one would spend $10 per ounce now.
No. That is how ridiculously fast this service was at the time, that people would pay that kind of money for it. The most famous Pony Express rider today is undoubtedly Buffalo Bill Cody. So he was a Pony Express rider, which I didn't know.
Interesting.
Yeah. But like I said, it didn't last. Russell, Majors, and Waddell had always hoped to get a government contract, so that's why they thought they could put this much money into it, because they thought Uncle Sam was going to back up a fucking stagecoach full of money towards them.
Sure.
But he didn't. It never happened, so they were operating as a private business with enormous overhead and an absurdly expensive service. The Pony Express was never profitable, but it was in some sense a victim of its own renown. News of Abraham Lincoln's election reached the West Coast in just a week, which was an incredible feat at the time, and it illustrated the need for rapid coast-to-coast communication. When the Transcontinental Telegraph Line reached Salt Lake City, Utah, connecting the eastern and western lines, communicating across the coasts suddenly became instantaneous, and the Pony Express was obsolete. It shut down on October 26, 1861, 2 days after the telegraph connection at Salt Lake was established, but it lives on in the mythology of the American West.
Indeed.
And Shonda Rhimes will probably do a weird period piece about it.
You know she didn't, like, create the Bridgerton story?
Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's a book.
So she'll probably find some obscure book about the Pony Express and turn it into a porno piece for Bored Housewives.
All right, whatever. She didn't turn Bridgerton into porno. I'm assuming that the books were also like that.
I'm sure there are terrible erotic novels about the Pony Express that she could license for $10.
Yep. All right, that brings us to our final segment, Fact or Fucked. And this one, as it has been of late, is from Cormac, our friend on Twitter.
Cormac sent a fearsome foursome's worth of factor fucks a few weeks back. So.
And he was kind enough to keep this last one short.
Thanks, Cormac.
Thank you. And you can find him on Twitter at Cormac's Thoughts.
And you should.
Yes. And he said, in his nice, short and sweet final factor fucked, Reese Witherspoon is Reese Witherspoon's surname. Her first name is Laura.
Probably. Reese is not a first name, it's a last name. But then again, this is exactly the kind of shit that he makes up. Fact.
It is fact. I knew that.
Okay.
It would have been funny if he was like, Reese Witherspoon is her last name. Her first name is Jessica.
Right. which, again, that is exactly the kind of shit he would pull, too.
No, it's Laura.
Okay.
Laura Jean Reese Witherspoon.
There you go. Didn't know that. She's awful. I don't like her at all.
I like her, and I knew that.
She's in terrible movies.
I like the movies.
All right, thanks, Cormac.
Thanks, and that's it. And I got four?
I believe you did. You got one in the first half, as you lamented.
Yep.
But I think you went 3 for 3 in the back half. Yeah,
yes.
So.
Woo!
Yeah, so you got Weezer in the first half, and then you got Norman Rockwell, Seinfeld, and the Pony Express. So, yes, another Four-point game in a season full of four-point games.
Yeah, no one has not gotten 4 points yet.
Yeah.
We'll see if we can get Justin down to 3 next week.
I hope not.
I hope so.
All right.
We shall see.
All right.
See you then.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Question
mail.
One.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
What was that?
Oh, it was a Blue's Clues reference.
Well, I'll be cutting that. Well, here's our little sleuth dog trying to get your attention. Are you going to leave a paw print and tell us something? No, you're just going to sit there looking handsome?
You're just
going
to keep the reference going then, even though you were annoyed with it?
Yep.
Cool.
No, he's just going to sit there and look handsome, because that's what he does. All right.